Welcome to Iconocast with Dr. Greg Layden and me, Mike Havrick. Iconocast is a show for science and science advocacy. Each episode explores important topical features in science with an eye towards public policy and public perception of the utility of basing our decisions on the findings of science properly investigated and reported. In episode 2 with Dr. Anastasia Bodner, we were talking about the drought in California and the ways in which agriculture is going to need to be modified due to water, weather, changes, and we also discussed the roots of the conflict in Syria and how that is related to a change in the availability of water. For this episode, we asked an expert in water resources and water conflict, Dr. Peter Glick of the Pacific Institute. I moved from Minnesota to Arizona in 2015, and I was keenly aware that water has a new dynamic here. Canals carry the precious resource uncovered and through the desert heat, allowing it to evaporate along the way. So I take fewer and shorter showers and wash the dishes with an eye to using water more efficiently. I avoid bottled water. It's probably not enough for the worldwide pressure of water needs, but when droughts are extended for years, conflicts inevitably arise as societies compete with each other and even within each other for diminishing resources. Dr. Peter Glick and Greg Layden, welcome to Iconocast.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Mike, and welcome, Peter. This, I guess the first question I'd like to ask you is about the California drought. Could you give us a basic primer on that? You know, how long has it been going? How bad is it? What areas does it cover? That sort of thing.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Let me start first by saying that there are lots of different definitions of drought. There's hydrologic drought, there's agricultural drought, there's environmental drought. When I talk about the California drought, I tend to argue that what we're really talking about is a state that increasingly doesn't have all the water that it needs to do the things that it wants. And in part, that's an issue of supply. California is certainly in a supply drought because of the vagaries of Mother Nature. But we're also in a demand drought in the sense that we have a growing population, we have a growing economy, and we have growing demands for water. And California, like much of the rest of the world, running up against limits in the water that's available for humans. Now, specifically for California, we've been in a drought for 4 years. Winter right now, we're sort of hoping that this rainy season will ease the drought, but we've certainly had 4 years in a row of very intense drought. Low rainfall, low snow, shortages of water, decreases in water available in reservoirs and soil moisture, cutbacks of deliveries of water, and it's statewide. The entire state is in a drought, according to the National Drought Mitigation Center, which measures these things. And there's growing competition for the limited water resources that we already have among farmers and cities and the environment. And so really, by any measure, the state is in a long, severe drought. Maybe we'll tackle this a little bit later, but I'm not entirely convinced that the current winter is going to get us out of the drought either.
Well, I was actually going to ask you that just now. We're now in the throes of a major El Nino, one of the biggest ones ever observed. And before the El Nino came, it was thought that that would at least help in California. Has it helped at all? Has there been enough rain, enough snowpack to make a difference?
Well, we're certainly in an El Nino, perhaps the strongest El Nino ever recorded. For California, El Ninos are a little ambiguous. They typically mean more rainfall in Southern California. They're a little less clear, a little less consistent in what they bring to Northern California. And because of the strength of this El Nino, there was hopes going into the rainy season, which in California starts October 1st, that we would get a lot of rain and snow this winter and that would really help ease, if not entirely eliminate, the drought. Unfortunately, that hasn't happened. It is a very strong El Nino, but there are other things going on as well. And currently, as of basically this week, our snowpack is actually below normal for this time of year. Our reservoirs continue to be way below normal for this kind of year. Runoff and precipitation have been almost normal, but below normal for this kind of year. And we don't need a normal year to get out of the drought. We need a really, really wet year. Now, there's still a month or two of the rainy season for California. We could have what some people call a miracle March, but I think that's unlikely to happen, and I think we're very likely to be facing a fifth year of drought.
So this might just be a slightly less severe year, but still a fifth year of the drought. And what's going to happen next year?
Well, next year, who knows? You know, we're good at predicting weather or forecasting weather 6 or 7 or maybe 10 days out. We're remarkably good in getting better at looking at long-term climate changes decades out. But we're terrible at trying to predict what's going to happen a year from now. The models are not appropriate for that. And we just don't know.
Are there any other things happening in California that are interesting because of El Nino? I was actually in San Diego last fall, summer, and I saw pilot whales, which apparently are not normally there in San Diego, but they were there because of El Nino changes in currents. Is there anything else interesting going on in California because of the current El Nino?
Well, there are all sorts of things associated with El Nino. El Nino, of course, for listeners who follow these things, means very high sea surface temperatures, especially in the eastern Pacific that's traveled across from the western Pacific. And those high temperatures bring quite dramatic changes in ecosystems, in the food chain off the Pacific, and where species are typically found. We see very, very far south species, Pacific species, appearing along the, as you pointed out, San Diego coast, and even further north towards San Francisco and even up toward the Gulf of Alaska. We see, in general, warm sea surface temperatures, and that affects the climate all along the west coast of the U.S. So there are all sorts of changes. El Nino brings all sorts of consequences globally, frankly, but they have not brought the hoped-for additional precipitation at the moment that we need to get out of the current drought.
Now, I've been expecting, because of the drought in California has been going on for 4 years now, so I've been expecting my sister who lives in California and all the other people who live there to show up as refugees any time now, because you must be having some serious consequences. How is the drought actually affecting agriculture in California right now?
Well, interestingly, it turns out that California is far more resilient in the short run to these kinds of changes in extreme weather events than we would otherwise expect. I guess another way to think about it is we're far less dependent economically on the kinds of variations we see in water availability because of the drought. And let me be a little more explicit about that. In California, 80% of the water that humans use goes to agriculture, and the other 20% of our water withdrawals go to urban use, that is commercial, industrial, residential, the stuff we use in our cities and in our homes.
And is that a very high percentage compared to other states?
It's a very high percentage compared to other states, but it's actually not that high a percentage globally. Globally, about 80% of water withdrawals goes to agriculture as well, because it takes a lot of water to grow food. And in that sense, California grows a lot of food, and so we commit a lot of water to the agricultural sector. In the short run, and by short run I really mean, for example, over the last 4 years of drought, the agricultural sector has been able to make up a lot of the shortfalls in surface water availability, a lot of the shortages of rainfall and runoff, first of all, by overdrafting groundwater, which is not a renewable, sustainable solution, but they've turned to that in the short run, and by drawing down our reservoirs. And the Pacific Institute, my institute, put out a report a few months ago looking at the agricultural impacts of the drought. And in fact, ag revenues are pretty high. Ag employment has been pretty high so far. We've been able to mitigate over the last 4 years the impacts of the drought economically. Now, if the drought continues, it's going to get harder and harder to do that. Our reservoirs are very low. We're massively overpumping groundwater, and that can't continue. But the short-term impacts of the drought economically have not been that substantial. Well, one other point about that. Despite the importance of agriculture in terms of water use in California, the agricultural sector is only about 4 or 5 or 6% of the state's economy. And so we're not that sensitive to short-term variations in water availability from an economic point of view.
So will there be changes in agriculture in California? Well, can we assume that even if this drought gets better over the next couple of years, that over the next decades, California will frequently or occasionally have multi-year droughts like it's having now?
Well, without a doubt, even without climate change, we get droughts, we have extreme events, we get floods. And climate change is now a factor that we have to take into account, and maybe we could talk a little bit more about that later. But even in the context of natural variability, California doesn't have as much water as it would like to do all the things that we want to do. And because of that, we're already seeing fundamental changes in agriculture. We're seeing changes in the acreage grown. We're seeing changes in the kinds of crops that are being grown. We're seeing changes in the methods used for irrigation. Farmers are basically trying to figure out how to grow more food more efficiently with less water. We see more nuts and fruits and vegetable crops and fewer of the water-intensive field crops like cotton and rice and alfalfa. And I think those changes will continue as we move forward, with or without changes in the frequency and intensity of drought.
Yeah, water itself isn't an agricultural product, but I know that you had written a book, Bottled and Sold, where you discussed how the bottled water industry is something that is also damaging for water supply, too. But I had been reading that Nestle's actually does have kind of a monopoly on a lot of spring water that would normally be used either for municipal water or even agriculture. How is that being affected by the drought?
Yeah, so I did write a book about bottled water, looking at the history of bottled water, sort of a strange story about why we drink bottled water and the industry and advertising and all of that. And in part because of the drought, there's been a growing awareness of and attention being paid to all sorts of different water uses that in the past we sort of either ignored or took for granted, and bottled water is one of those. There was a flurry of interest in the last year or two about the amount of water that's being used in California for bottling that's either consumed in California or shipped out of state, and some interest in figuring out how to better regulate and manage that, and I think that's a good thing. It's not a huge amount of water. The total amount of water used by the bottled water industry, whether or not that's an appropriate use at all, is a very tiny fraction of the water that's used by the agricultural sector or by the urban sector. Certainly, we should pay attention to it. It ought to be better monitored. It ought to be better reported. It ought to be better regulated.
So what is the impact of climate change on it? Is the California drought caused by climate change, and do you expect that to be more of a problem in the future because of climate change?
So the issue of climate change, of course, is fundamentally tied to the question of the current drought and the future likelihood of extreme events, wet or on the frequency and intensity of extreme events, and the effect of temperature on demand. I wrote a paper last year with Michael Mann that looked at the role that temperature increases have played in worsening, not causing, but influencing the California drought. The last 4 years in California have been the driest 4 years in the instrumental record, but they've also been the hottest 4 years in the instrumental record, and hot temperatures increases the demand for water. It increases the loss of water from soils and from vegetation. It increases the loss of soils of water from our reservoir surfaces as well. In addition, climate change, as I think we all increasingly understand, is affecting quite dramatically the Arctic and Arctic ice. And there's been some interesting science looking at the way that loss of ice may change pressure systems in the Gulf of Alaska, which influence how much water California gets. All of these things are related. As the climate gets worse and worse, as we change more and more of the climate system, we are going to see more and more impacts on California and, frankly, every place else around the world. And some of those changes are going to be changes in extreme events, like the frequency and intensity of floods and droughts.
Peter, you've written about the drought in Syria. I think a really important you've done some really important work on that, suggesting that the drought in Syria had wide-ranging socio-political and economic impacts that we're feeling globally. Could you talk a bit about that?
Sure. So that's another example of our resources, including social stability and economic well-being, and ultimately the risks of conflict. Syria, of course, is in the midst of a horrible civil war and a conflict that has roots going back to ancient times in terms of history, in terms of religious ideology, in terms of economics and social structure. But it's also true, I believe, that the conflict in Syria has been influenced by water issues and influenced by climate change. And in particular, a very severe drought that scientists argue has been influenced by climate change struck the eastern Mediterranean around what we think of as Mesopotamia, the area of Syria and Iraq and southern Turkey and Israel and Jordan and Lebanon, starting in the mid-2000s. And that drought got worse and worse, and it influenced agricultural production in Syria. It led to a very significant decrease in agricultural productivity, in part because of not just the hydrologic changes, but bad water management in Syria. That, in turn, led to a very substantial migration of young, unemployed, primarily men, to many of the cities in Syria, where some of the most significant economic unrest started, unrest that led to and contributed to the ongoing civil war. These things are all related. Conflicts are complicated. No one is arguing, or at least I'm not arguing, that the conflict in Syria was a climate war or a water war. It wasn't. It was caused by a lot of different things. But we do see a growing influence of climatic factors and water-related factors in conflicts around the world. Interestingly, we maintain something at the Pacific Institute called the Water Conflict Chronology. It's a database, the most complete database of water-related conflicts, going back over 4,000 years around the world. And in the last several decades, we've seen a very significant increase in violence associated with water availability, water conflicts, attacks on water systems, the use of water as a weapon. It's a worrisome trend, and it's related to this tension over water issues around the world.
In thinking about Syria and California, I've been wondering, there's two different places that have had a drought, and they've had very different, to the extent that drought has influenced things there in both places, they've had very different responses. And as you say, it's not strictly a case of climate change causing a civil war, but is the difference between Syria and California because the droughts were different levels of severity and because the social, economic, and agricultural systems were different, or is it primarily mainly a difference in the agriculture?
Well, certainly the risk of conflict over resources has a key component of that is going to be how those resources are affected by climate change and by extreme events. But in fact, probably more important is our institutional and social and economic and political ability to respond to these things. This is related to the issue of climate adaptation as well. The places that are most at risk of climate change are in part the places where climate changes the most, but really they're going to be the places that are least able, for political or economic or social reasons, to adapt to those changes. The conflict in Syria was worsened by institutional failures, by existing social and political tensions, by bad water management. I don't expect farmers in California to take up arms. I don't think things will get that bad. We have the institutional mechanisms to deal with these kinds of conflicts, and we may exchange heated words, but at least hopefully we're not going to be exchanging gunfire over these issues here. And that's part of the response. We have to figure out how to respond to these kinds of threats in a way that reduces the risk of conflicts for the people most vulnerable.
Well, depending on how the election goes, I hear they might build a wall separating California from the rest of the country if things get bad there. I want to ask you about some other things in a moment, but while we're still talking about water, you have done some research on the concept of virtual water, sort of trading water across countries and regions. Can you talk about that a little bit? What is virtual water, and you know, where can I get some?
So you use it all the time. So there are really two pieces to that puzzle. One is called virtual water. The other is basically called... So there are really two issues here. One is the concept of what we call virtual water, and the other is the water footprint. The idea of the water footprint is how much water is embedded in the things that we do and consume. How much water does it take to make a T-shirt, to grow the cotton, to run the factory? How much water does it take to make consume as a society? Have a water footprint because it takes water to do those things. Some of the water that we consume comes from other places, and we typically refer to that as virtual water. It's the water that we trade in the goods and services that we trade. We're not actually moving that much water around the planet, but we move goods and services around the planet. And so when we buy a computer from Asia or an iPhone made overseas, we're importing that electronic equipment, but we're also consuming water that was used in those countries where that product was made. And that's the idea of virtual water trade. Now, we did a study at the Pacific Institute looking at the water footprint of California, how much water we use in California to produce the goods and services that we produce here, minus the water embedded in the goods and services we export to other places, plus the water in the goods and services that we import from other places. We export a lot of water and food that we grow here. We import a lot of water and the goods and services that we import. And a lot of that water comes from China. That virtual water comes from China or the other places that we buy goods and services from.
So is there a way to use this concept to balance out water differences in water access or water availability?
Well, I think it's useful for understanding the consequences of our decisions as consumers. It's useful for understanding the impacts of our choices as consumers. If you're using water basically that's coming from a water-scarce part of the world, you may have a greater impact than if you chose to grow that food locally or produce that product locally. And we're not very good at understanding either what those impacts are or incorporating those consequences in our decisions. In that sense, the concept of the water footprint and virtual water is a useful one. And if we're going to move toward long-term sustainable management of our water resources, I think the more we know about those choices and those implications, the better.
This sort of brings up something that always bothers me, and that is a lot of people are very well-meaning and interested in doing the right thing when it comes to the environment, but they have too little information about what that is that they should be doing. Or maybe they're not all that well-meaning, but they're a little well-meaning, and they want to feel like they're doing the right thing, so they recycle everything they can recycle and then do nothing else. So they drive their SUV and drink bottled water and burn trash in their yard, but they recycle so they feel like they're doing the right thing. But as you pointed out, for example, I think bottled water is a problem, and I think that it's a ridiculous use of resources, and the plastic bottles are a problem. But when it comes to the amount of let me give you an example. There's an ad that I've seen recently, I think maybe it was on the Super Bowl, where somebody is shaving, I think, and the water is running in his sink, which is a waste of water. But while the water is running, a small child from Mexico comes over and wash and gets a drink from the faucet, indicating that this is a waste of water, just underscoring that point. But if this person has got a well in their house and they live in a rainforest like in the Pacific Northwest, it really doesn't help that kid in Mexico at all that they're saving their water. Whereas if they live where Mike does in the desert, it may make a huge difference. It really depends on your context a lot. We talked on this show a while back about a couple of ideas like having a C value for products, where a C of a zero means we didn't use any fossil carbon to make this product or get it to your house. And a C of 100 means we use lots of it. And you can decide what you want to buy based upon that value, or a sustainable agriculture index, or a clean energy index. And this sounds like this idea would be great because it would be a way people can actually use scientifically measured, indexed water footprint information that means something to make the right decision, instead of a decision that simply makes them feel good and doesn't really have an impact or as much of an impact.
Yeah, I think those are really important points. I actually liked that particular Super Bowl ad, if not just for the fact that it was a little more socially responsible than most of the other consumer products that you see at the Super Bowl. But it reminds us that there are things that we can do in our individual lives and our individual behavior that can reduce our use of water, in that case, or other resources. But it's also certainly true that we don't, as individuals or even as a society, have a good understanding of the comprehensive consequences of our choices, either locally or globally. You know, it's one thing to say, well, it takes more water to make this meal rather than that meal in terms of the total water footprint of our food choices. But we also do need to know, where is that water coming from? It may be that it's a more sustainable use to grow something where it's fed by rainfall rather than fed by irrigated agriculture in an arid region. Mm-hmm. These are complicated questions. I'm glad we're beginning to ask them. The answers are sometimes not simple, But the more we know about the consequences of our choices, I think the more likely we are, at least some of us, to make better decisions.
You know, another thing that is probably people should try to be better at is behaving in a way that is more adaptable to the immediate situation. I think, for example, where I live, we have very sandy soil. 2 years ago, 3 years ago, and 4 years ago, somewhere around there, if you didn't water your lawn pretty regularly for the warmest and driest part of the summer, the lawn would die and turn brown, and it would be a bad lawn. Since that time, in the last 2 years, I don't think I've watered the lawn once, because it just happens that the rain has fallen at the right time, and the weather has just been perfect for the lawn. But I think what people do is they get into a habit of addressing a problem that emerges, and then they continue to address that problem thereafter, even when it doesn't happen. It's like the old story of the person who cuts the roast a certain way before baking it, and everyone wonders why, and they ask, and the cook says, well, that's how Grandma did it. And one day this comes up, and Grandma is there, and Grandma says, yeah, I used to do that because our roasting pan was too small. That's not a problem anymore, but it's become a tradition. You know, I think that having a way in which people can there's been discussions about having smart grids where your electricity supply is a bit smarter. Your appliance can turn on when the electricity is more readily available and less expensive or cleaner, less fossil fuels and so on. There's probably ways to do that with water as well, to have more adaptable, better, more immediate, useful information that actually could make a small change in your behavior make a bigger difference.
One thing that's happening here in Phoenix is that a lot of developers in like new residential developments will they'll design them so that the houses don't have grass lawns anymore, that they have to water and use up a lot of water resources for that, but will be specifically landscaped for rocks and other type of sandy yards with cactus around them and try to save water that way. So there are changes being made down here as well, kind of along that regard.
Yeah, Peter, in terms of water use in a place like California, let's say where people live in California, in L.A., San Diego, et cetera, what's more important, lawns, golf courses, bottled water, or agriculture? I assume agriculture is a big one, but you know, how do these relate to each other?
Well, so all of those things are important in a state where water is simply no longer plentiful and readily available. You know, you raise an interesting point. There are technical solutions to water problems, and then there are behavioral ones as well. So agriculture is the big user in California. Now it varies. The focus of California's agriculture is the Central Valley. We don't grow much food in the San Francisco Bay Area or the Los Angeles Basin itself. Those urban centers, for urban water use, or in particular for residential water use, statewide about half of our residential water use is indoors and half is outdoors. In the hotter areas of California, more of that is outdoors, and it's associated with our choices about landscaping. And Mike's point about lawns, and Greg, you made this comment as well, we tend to have a lot of lawns in the western U.S. and in California, and part of the discussion about long-term water sustainability is that an appropriate outdoor landscape for the climate that we live in? We could have beautiful gardens in the western U.S. that use a lot less water than we currently use, but that's not the way we used to do it. That's not the way our grandparents did it, and that requires a fundamental change in our behavior and our societal choices, and we're beginning to see that. Arizona has moved quite extensively, in at least parts of Arizona, away from traditional green grass toward more appropriate landscaping, and we're beginning to see that in California as well, and that's a way to save a lot of water. That's a consumptive use of water that's purely cosmetic. And as the drought continued for the last 4 years, we saw an effort to try and get rid of some of those grass lawns, to try and cut some of that outdoor landscaping, in part because it's one of those things that we haven't addressed previously.
Now, I was actually shocked to learn that certain communities in California were installing water meters in houses. Because everywhere I've ever lived, there's always been a water meter, and you always have to pay for your water.
Right, you were shocked to learn, in fact, that we haven't already done that.
Yeah.
It's an outrage. California has done some remarkable things in water. We've made great progress in improving water efficiency. Our agriculture is shifting its structure and its form. We're beginning to recycle highly treated wastewater. We're doing some very sophisticated things, and yet we have houses with no water meters. We don't measure and monitor all agricultural uses of water. Until last year, we didn't have any groundwater law. There are things that are remnants of our history that are the results of 150 years of bad water management that have finally come back to haunt us, that we're slowly beginning to change, but that are related to this issue of institutions. We're not going to solve our water problems with purely technical solutions. There are some important institutional things that we need to do, and installing water meters and measuring and reporting all water use is without a doubt one of those.
It's interesting that in California, I think a lot of people think of California as a special kind of state. It is a special kind of state. It's like its own country, and it's politically relatively progressive, and it seems like there's a commitment to education until recently at Berkeley and so on. But it's also a Western state in a lot of ways, isn't it? It's ideologically not as different from the other Western states as one might think. I'm reading a book, reviewing a book right now about earthquakes, and it's interesting to note that the first great California quake, which is not the big one in San Francisco of 1905, but earlier in the 19th century, the difference in time between the first quake and the first time that everybody who built anything had to take into account where they were in relation to fault lines as a zoning regulation was 102 years. So that's how long it took, mostly because the developers repressed. The first two quakes in California, that in the San Francisco area, were actually covered up. They didn't want anyone to know that they had happened. They didn't actually cover them up. They weren't successful completely covering them up, but they really downplayed them and made them seem unimportant and forestalled regulations on development for over 100 years, which to me is a kind of a Texas thing to do or an Arizona thing to do, but it happened in California.
Well, there's no doubt that there are things that we know deep down we ought to be doing in terms of more sustainable water management that we don't do because of traditional reasons, historical reasons, political reasons that we're going to have to fix if we're going to hope to move toward a sustainable future.
By the way, here in Minnesota, the key issue, the more important cost issue for communities is probably sewage. So if you can prove that you're watering your lawn differently than everyone else's, you can actually get a break on your water bill because the water bill is meant to actually cover the cost of processing wastewater more than, because it's assumed that when you put out a new lawn, you're putting out a lot of water. That's assumed to be sewage you're putting back into the system. And you can call up the city in some cities and say, I just seeded my lawn. I'm watering it every day for a week. And they'll take a little bit off your water bill because they're really more concerned with the sewage than with the water going into the system.
Yeah, we have a similar issue here. My water bill covers both the cost of water and the cost of sewage treatment. And the cost of sewage treatment is assumed to be related to the volume of water that I use, even if, as you point out, I'm using some of it on my lawn and it doesn't actually increase the sewage load. Those are the kinds of more sophisticated water management and water rate structures that I think we're going to have to put in place.
Now, changing topics a little bit, I wanted to get your read on the current state of science denial, in particular climate change science denial. We've been seeing a lot of interesting things lately. In the last couple of years, for the first time, the President of the United States has actually made a point to verify that climate change is real and that denialism of climate change is not. That, to me, is even almost bigger to actually call out the deniers, which are his own colleagues in Washington. We've seen climate change kind of coming into the less than I would like to see it, but it's coming into the election cycle as an issue. Where do you think we stand? Have we seen a high watermark of climate science denial in the United States in the last months or years, or are we still going to be fighting this battle as we have been for some time?
Well, I think we've seen the high watermark. I'd like to think that that's true. I do think we will continue to be fighting this battle. The science of climate change is incredibly good. You know, there's plenty of good science that still needs to be done on climate change, but we understand with a very high degree of confidence that the climate's changing and that humans are responsible and that the impacts are going to be bad and that the cost of dealing with this is going to be far less if we address it now than the cost of dealing with the consequences. But there has been, as you know, Greg, and as many of us know, a long history of efforts to deny the quality of that science, to pretend that that science isn't good, in part to slow action, to slow policy responses, in part to confuse the public, and I think the public gets it more and more as extreme weather becomes more and more obvious. I think the evidence is unambiguous. If you look what's happening in the Arctic, our temperatures are, frankly, just open your eyes, and it's increasingly hard to deny the reality of climate change. But that doesn't mean people won't continue to do so for political and ideological reasons. And I think that's going to be a battle that those of us in the science community, to some degree, are going to have to continue to face.
I think to some extent it's a bit like the Civil Rights Movement in a way. I doubt very much that on the day that the Civil Rights Act was passed by Congress in the United States that the majority of Americans stopped being racist. I think that people who had racist ideologies learned to become more quiet about it a little bit, and courts started to work differently, and the legal system started to work differently. And I think with climate change, to some extent, we're going to see that happen. We're not going to see... I think if we wait for everyone to get on board with climate change, to move forward with it on a policy level, we're going to be in trouble. And I think that it has to be simply leadership has to take a role, and think people in positions of responsibility and power have to just do things. And even the most ardent climate denialists, unless it's their job, are not going to go out and do anything about that. They're just busy with other things. They're relatively apathetic and not active.
Well, I think that's right. And I think there will always be some degree of denial. There will always be some people who either don't understand because they're not sure about the science, or don't understand because they're paid not to understand. Maybe a better example is, it's sort of hard to believe in this day and age that there are actually people who think the Earth is flat. But there are some. And as ridiculous as that sounds, that there will always be a community that you cannot convince about some aspect of reality. And you have to work around them. You have to ignore them. You have to marginalize them. You have to make them not be in positions where they can influence policy that's going to affect the rest of us or the planet. And I think we have a long way to go to deal with climate change on that level. But I am somewhat optimistic that the reality of climate change, which is still obvious, is sinking in and beginning to reach policymakers. But another important point is, we're beginning to see action on climate change, not necessarily effective action at the federal level, but at the state and local level. California has a cap-and-trade system, and our economy not only hasn't collapsed, but our economy's booming. More and more nations are addressing climate change and showing that it's to their economic and social advantage to do so. And even if the world of climate denial exists and shrinks to some small area around Washington, D.C., I think there's an opportunity to make progress at the local level and ultimately at the global level, even in the face of that kind of continued science denial.
Great. I think that, Peter, that might be almost what we need to do. I just want to add one quick comment, and that is, in Minnesota, just for your interest, in Minnesota, we're actually having a situation where we're competing with our neighbors, North and South Dakota, and probably Montana, because we are moving faster than they are to getting a higher percentage of clean energy production, electricity production, mm-hmm. and that's worth more than the dirty electricity because of regulations. If a state passes a law that says we have to get to 35% clean energy by a certain date, they can do it by buying the energy from other states. So those states can make money by selling it to them. So there's a slowly ratcheting up market for clean energy, and if you're the state that's ahead, you get to sell your neighbors who are behind. It's like the question of how fast you have to be to outrun a lion, just a little faster than the guy you're with. You know, we're playing that game in the upper Midwest now. Kind of interesting.
So I think that's a really good example of the ability to make progress on some of these issues at the local level or at the state level, even if there is resistance at the federal level. California has a renewable portfolio standard. We have a target of 50% renewable energy by 2030. We're already at 30%, and it's growing very, very rapidly. We've seen rapid expansion of wind and solar because it's economic, because it's cleaner, because we've broken through the barrier that makes these things make sense. And that's part of what gives me optimism that in the long run, we're going to be able to address these problems. The trick is to do it fast enough so that we can avoid some of the worst impacts that will happen if we're too slow.
It's also, by the way, cool. You know, if you have solar panels in your house In some areas, I'm told that if a house with solar panels on it isn't necessarily worth more than it is the identical house down the street, but it will sell faster.
Mm-hmm. I think it's worth more, too.
Well, it may be worth
more. That's a good example.
Yes. And you know, it's basically cool to be able to do that. And what I find interesting is people will argue to the death over the actual value of the solar panel by saying, no, it was made by Chinese people in China using coal, you know, so therefore it's actually worse to put it on your house than to not put it on your house, and so on. And so therefore you're being stupid by spending this money on a solar panel, but then go to Best Buy and buy an even bigger TV at the current cost when it first comes out, spending thousands of dollars on your, you know, AV equipment, which makes no sense. So in other words, if you're going to spend money on a trip to Mexico or getting a ticket to go into outer space when they can do that, or some other fancy extravagance, that's fine. No one ever asks for the rationale and argues over the details of whether it is economically sensible to waste your money on something when it's for fun. But when it comes to clean energy, people will argue heavily, but actually that's also for fun.
Without a doubt, the United States is going to miss a bet if it doesn't invest in the national infrastructure to build renewable energy. You know, we could end up buying panels and wind turbines from other countries, but we have the opportunity, and we've seen this already, in expanding jobs in the United States in the renewable energy system. And it's also true that a kilowatt hour of electricity that we do not generate with dirty carbon-based fuels, but that we generate with renewables, is a better kilowatt hour. And we're seeing more and more of that, and I think that's good news.
Well, thank you for listening to this third episode of Iconocast. Please share it with anyone who will benefit. I want to thank Greg Layden, my broadcast partner, and especially want to thank Dr. Peter Glick for being an entertaining and gracious guest. Peter has published several books and collections on the subject of fresh water as a resource, and we have included links for you to purchase them. Water in Crisis, A Guide to the World's Freshwater Resources, edited by Dr. Glick. Bottled and Sold, The Story Behind the Obsession with Bottled Water. And by purchasing these at Amazon through these links at iconocast.com, you support our science advocacy. We appreciate it. Our next episode will launch in March. Watch for it at iconocast.com. And thank you again for listening, and we appreciate your feedback.